The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, bringing you honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Nikki and Mariam, maternal health counsellor and doula respectively, and co-founders of Root and Bloom. If you heard our previous conversation, you'll remember their passion for supporting mothers through pregnancy, postpartum and beyond. Today, we're catching up with them again to hear more about their work, their upcoming new monthly Mums and Bumps coffee morning in St. Albans, and a topic many families will be thinking about as the summer holidays approach: relationships, boundaries, juggling the balance, and how can we protect our well-being during those busy weeks ahead. Welcome back to The Parents Show, Nikki and Mariam.
Hi, Lisa. Nice to see you.
Lovely to be back. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming back. So for the listeners who may have missed our previous conversation, can you tell us a little about Root and Bloom, how you met and what inspired you to create this community together?
Yeah, so we created Root and Bloom. We met through a network of perinatal practitioners and we got chatting and we realised that there's a real gap in emotional support for pregnant and new mums. You know, if you're healthy, physically healthy, if the baby's physically healthy, off you go. But it's really missing the fact that some mums really, really struggle with their mental health. So we just wanted to fill in that gap, really.
Yeah, and we also noticed with a lot of the mums that we work with, you know, gone are the days where they have the support of their village. You know, neighbours don't walk in and out of our homes anymore. A lot of people don't even live that close to their own parents or sisters or aunties. So that network of support around a couple when they have a baby is near enough gone in many ways. So we were really, really keen to bring that village back because we know the value of it and how important it can be.
And I think we also want to basically spread the word about matrescence, which, you know, most mums I speak to still have never heard of it. And basically what it is the profound physical, emotional, social change that happens when you become a mum and actually carries on throughout motherhood. This is like adolescence, but for mums. And I think it's really important for mums to understand that everybody goes through this and that whatever you're feeling is okay. Mm-hmm. It's not strange. It's not different. It's not bad. All mums are going through difficult times and it's okay to talk about it. So I think that's a big sort of thing we want mums to understand as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. And since we last spoke, because you had just come together not long before we spoke, What have you been hearing most often from the mothers and the families you support? What challenges are they most often facing?
I think a recurring theme is that of guilt, actually. And guilt can be a really tricky emotion to understand. Because, I mean, a lot of the times it's guilty for feeling a certain way or thinking a certain way. And like Nikki was saying, it's actually, well, actually two things can coexist. You can be over the moon and, you know, so in love with your new baby, but you can also find it hard. You can also find that challenging. And it's not about loving every minute because that's just not always going to be possible. It's guilt about, you know, with their relationship with their partners. Obviously, when you have a new baby, even if you've got children before, the dynamics each time a new baby comes into a family change every time. So there's guilt there. There's guilt about work for a lot of women nowadays who have gone on maternity leave to have their babies. It's very difficult to actually switch off from work. So there's guilt there as well. So I think guilt is something that comes up again and again.
It's huge.
For lots of families.
Yeah. And I think also, something I'm hearing is, why am I not coping, or why am I not doing a good enough job? And you know, they may feel like they're not coping. In some instances they won't be. There's that heightened anxiety or overwhelm or that kind of thing, but often it's just comparison. And nowadays in the world of social media, it's so easy to compare yourself with other mums and what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing, and then that's that constant thought in your head. So it's really important, and this is what I like to tell my clients. I struggle with it, so I know it's not easy, but it's about being kind to yourself as much as you can and know you're doing a good job. And actually your child, your baby, loves you unconditionally anyway. They think you're doing an amazing job, so you don't have to live up to all these expectations that come from outside noise, basically.
Yeah, Yeah, definitely. And that starts even before the baby's born. You know, when women are pregnant, they're already in that loop of comparing themselves and comparing their birth prep and comparing their birth desires, you know, what outcomes they want and how they want to birth and things like that. And everybody's an individual, right? Everybody has their own individual makeup, their own individual opinions, their health, you know, matters that may affect pregnancy or birth. And to compare yourself at that stage, it just continues then and grows and spirals. So yeah, checking in is super important.
Yeah.
I guess that leads also to a lot of feeling of being judged and then perhaps afraid to speak how you're really feeling because you're afraid of being judged because you think you're saying something that is not normal, it's not what everybody else is thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of, mums are just expected to get on with it because we've done it for millions of years and you should be fine. And, you know, there's no, so then that you put that pressure on yourself as well, but it's come from society. Like you should just be able to get on with it. And when you feel you can't, again, the guilt and feel bad about yourself. So it's a really, really hard time.
Yeah. And so we wanted to touch on the summer holidays, which are coming up, which can bring excitement. And for families who've got multiple children, maybe school age children, that's going to mean quite a different balance of work, family life, holidays, childcare pressures. For parents of younger children and not at that stage, things also change because a lot of the usual support networks actually sort of close down a bit, don't they? Because lots of us mums who run the baby and children's classes, we take off with our school age children. And, you know, I work with mothers of young children myself and they're like, are you doing sessions in the summer? Because that's a long time to potentially feel a little bit isolated and not having your usual routine. So what are some of the biggest challenges you find that parents sort of tend to face during this time of year?
I think the mental load is, you know, year round, it's 24/7. But I think especially mums with older children who might have babies as well, it's everything that you kind of, mums tend to be, not always, but tend to be like the default planner, the default parent. So they have to think about childcare. They have to think about activities to do. And again, there's a lot of pressure to have this amazing summer and do all the things. And, you know, so I think the mental load is a big thing.
We hear the phrase mental load quite a lot.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that mental load?
I think when I picture it, it's like having a million tabs open in your head, and it's all the different things. So it's not anything that's seen, which I think it makes it harder for people, like even partners, to understand. It's what you're thinking. I've got to take so and so to football. I've got to make dinner. I've got to organize clubs. I've got to organize childcare. Like I've got to sort out school uniform. There's so many things, and it's exhausting to have that all going on in your head at the same time.
Yeah, and not knowing necessarily where to prioritize because there's everything feels like a priority potentially.
Yeah, and then you become not a priority,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Really common. And I think, again, social media has a lot to answer for because when you look on, you know, Instagram or TikTok or whatever, everybody's having these amazing, exciting holidays and, you know, they're doing beautiful crafting activities if they're at home, and if they're not at home, they're visiting all these gorgeous, educational, fun, you know, et cetera, places. So a lot of the times, again, the mums who are the planners of the family in most cases are thinking they need to constantly have something planned. And, you know, actually, you would know this one, you're like the Montessori rule. Actually, we need our children to be curious, to have opportunity to be bored so that they can be creative about how they're going to entertain themselves. But that can be really uncomfortable to people sit with, to have a day of nothing's planned, and that can be really unsettling for some people. And then obviously with lovely things and activities that you're doing outside of your home, I think for a lot of people over the summer they also do worry about financial strains, especially if, you know, you're in a family where both mum and dad usually work but currently one is on maternity leave. Then, you know, financially to be able to afford all those lovely activities can also be challenging. And we're talking about the mental load, you know, aside from just to-do lists, it's also to-be lists, right? That comes under your mental load. You need to be calm, but you also need to be attentive. You need to be this. You also need to be that. And yeah, gosh, it's just endless, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure. And I think, yeah, we can get caught in that trap of planning too much over the summer holiday. And then we further burnt out, or the guilt of not again, back to that guilt, the guilt of not planning enough for our children, or the fear of what would a whole day be like without anything planned.
Yeah.
Actually, really how most of our summer holidays were spent when we were children, probably.
Okay, yeah. And we were okay.
So with all of this going on over the next few weeks, do you have any simple tips and strategies for managing these pressures and trying to maintain a positive connection with your partner, your children, your family, when life feels quite busy and everyone's all in the same space?
I think it can be easy to start to feel resentful, particularly of your partner, like, oh, I'm doing everything and you're doing nothing. And so I think it's important to have a conversation with your partner and say, I need help with this. Can you take this over? You know, just little things, or like, you know, bedtime, I just can't do it tonight. Can you please do it? Just voicing what you need, basically. And that's hard because, again, you feel the pressure of having to do it all. You should be able to do it all. But if you can take some of that load away, that's really helpful.
And I think the key is good communication. I've got somebody I know who they have a very simple way of communicating. When the partner comes home from work and the wife has been at home with their young children, they will just have a very quick exchange. How was your day? Da-da-da-da. What are you at? And the idea is that they'll tell each other their battery percentage. Mm. So if mum says, oh, I'm at 20%, dad knows that he's got to give it 80% that evening. So rather than, again, taking away from the mental load, they've already had this discussion and they've had it once and that's enough. I'm not going to sit and tell you all the things that need to be done. It should be enough for you to know that I'm at 20%, so you need to pick up the 80%. Mm. On another day, he might come home and he might say, oh, I'm at 10% today. I've had a shocking day at the office. You did a little. So she'll know, okay, 90% of it, it's me today. So, you know, to have whatever works in your relationship, but to communicate, I think that's really, really key.
Yeah.
Because you can't assume that the other person's going to know. You do have to spell it out sometimes, and that's okay.
Yeah. And it can be frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I feel like mums, is stereotyping slightly, but mums see everything that needs to be done and understand everything that needs to be done. Dads don't always. I mean, that's stereotyping, but it can, you know, it can be frustrating. Mm. And there are apps you can get as well with, you know, to plan your diary and like things that need doing. And so even if you don't really feel you've got time to talk about it, you can allocate and try and sort it out that way.
I remember my simple method of communication with my first child was, as soon as my husband walked through the door, I just passed him the baby.
Yeah.
I'm going for a bath. That was it.
That's great, though. That's good.
Your turn. But I do think it's also tricky, and I still find this today, and my children are 10 and 14. If the other half, whether that's husband, wife, whatever, comes back and they've had such a different sort of a day with different sorts of pressures, and you've had your different day, and there's that tension. How do you both get on the same wavelength? And sometimes that can lead to like frustrations and arguing and resentment. And I guess potentially this is will be potentially exacerbated in the summer holidays if you're feeling a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the times it's a case of not competing with one another. You're not in competition with your partner. They are allowed to have a difficult day and you are allowed to have a difficult day as well. And they're different kinds of difficult, and that's all right. Yeah. So I think it is that realizing that actually it doesn't need to be competition. Hold space for each other and yourself, and it doesn't need solving. So if your partner comes home and vents as to how difficult their day was, they're not asking you to fix it. And I think sometimes that can lead to frustration, is where, you know, one partner or the other thinks they need to solutionize the situation. They need to offer a solution. They need to fix it. Well, actually, all that's being asked for you really is just to hold space in that moment. Just listen to your partner, let them vent, let them get it out. And it's like, yeah, that sounds like it's been a really tough day.
Yeah.
That's all it needs, really.
Yeah.
And I guess if children are older, they could take some of the mental loads too, couldn't they?
Definitely.
They could do more of the chores. One thing I intend to do is, we have our kind of usual chores, but in the holidays, some of that can be an opportunity to earn some money. So we have a little kind of price list of extra jobs that, you know, cleaning the windows, that kind of thing, not the everyday jobs that they can earn money for. And then that can give them some autonomy. They could get some more freedom and responsibility that could reduce some of your mental load.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Definitely.
And so boundaries, that's a word we hear more and more about. what do we mean when we're talking about boundaries in regards to sort of relationships, and what do healthy boundaries actually look like for parents, and how can we hold them?
Yeah, so boundaries is an interesting one, isn't it? And I think it's something that's incredibly important for us as mothers. It's important at work. It's important in our intimate relationships. And, you know, to have a healthy boundary means it's a boundary that's not too porous. So we can all think of porous boundaries, and often our nearest and dearest are the ones that we hold porous boundaries with. Because if a child, for example, asks something of us, even if we're empty in our tank, we will often as mothers find a way to give that child what they're asking for and what they need, rather than saying, well, actually, this is what I need at this moment, and that's my boundary, and it stays there. So porous boundaries are boundaries that will crumble, and, you know, we end up feeling worse off because of that. And then, of course, we're on the other end of the spectrum, we've got rigid boundaries where you have absolutely zero flexibility. This is what I'm doing. I'm staying in that lane regardless of what's going on here and what's going on there. And that can equally be unhealthy and also difficult. Mm. And that's often where relationships will struggle, because you need an element of compromise, right, in any relationship. So a healthy boundary would be a boundary where, on the majority of it, you can stay within your chosen area. That's you know, what you're comfortable in. That's your lane. However, you do understand that sometimes we need to be flexible. If a child is poorly, or if a husband or a partner is caught up at work, and therefore you've had to be flexible in your boundary to accommodate something else. You know, these things happen in real life. So I think a healthy boundary is sometimes flexible, but flexible for that moment, to get over that situation, and then you can get back to your own lane and set those boundaries up again. So it needs to be something that can be movable, right? And I think sometimes, as women, oftentimes it's very difficult to set our boundaries, because everybody assumes, not everybody, again, I'm generalizing, but oftentimes it's assumed that we have this endless capacity to keep giving, to keep giving, to keep giving. And often what happens is women, mothers, fall into that. And they get to the point where they are so touched out, they're so overstimulated, that a child just coming and tapping them on the knee can be the small thing that's going to tip them over the edge that day. Mm. So to be able to set boundaries means that actually in the long run, we're kinder to ourselves, but also people around us appreciate those boundaries, because they will see better versions of us. Mm. But to be able to set those in the first place can be incredibly difficult for some people. Yeah. I think that's something that we talk about with the ladies that we support.
Yeah.
And talk about, and we, you know, do a bit of role play about, okay, so let's practice. What are you going to say to have a conversation to set that boundary? And that can be quite uncomfortable sometimes.
And I think a lot of women I meet are, and I'm probably the same, a self-proclaimed people pleasers.
Yeah.
So they don't want to say, actually, can you do this? They'd rather just take everything on themselves and keep everyone happy in theory. But like Maren was explaining, that doesn't keep everyone happy, particularly you.
There's no prizes for doing it all on your own.
Exactly.
Nope. Yeah.
Our listeners who do find this difficult, which is possibly a lot, what's one small step you could suggest to still protect their time and energy this summer in particular, with these kind of holiday, summer period, everything sort of changes up a bit?
I think, for example, if you're asked to do something, go somewhere, or, you know, if you can give yourself a chance to take a step back and think about, do I actually want to do this? Do I have the capacity mentally and practically to do this? And then if you think no, that's absolutely fine. You know, I heard somewhere no is a complete sentence. Maybe not always. You might sometimes need to give an explanation, but saying no is absolutely okay to protect yourself from feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also sometimes the summer holidays can be challenging because you're on a different routine, or you're in no routine. So one of the things that can be really helpful, and I find this personally myself, is regardless of whatever else is going on during the day, what everybody else is doing, what's planned, just to have one thing in your routine that is constant. And even if that's just having a drink of water in a particular glass at a certain, you know, roundabout a certain time each day, then try and stay consistent with that. Try and make sure that for those 5 minutes, 2 minutes, whatever it might be, that you are mindfully having that glass of water and you stick to that. So no matter what else the day brings, that part of the day, every day, is going to be consistent. It's going to be the same for you. That can be really grounding and really helpful, because that's safe and predictable and all those things.
It's an anchor that you can keep coming back to every day. And kind of one of the things that I often say to the mums that I work with is, not only is this good for you, these setting boundaries, these having moments of self-care, something for you, even if it's just a glass of water in that same cup in the same space, not only is it great for you, it's setting a really good role model for your children. Because I find it easier sometimes to do things if I know it's good for my children, because that, you know, it frees up the mom. It makes me feel good about it. But if I realize me setting boundaries with my children is actually teaching my children to set boundaries themselves. So when they are in that position that they need to set boundaries, they know how to do it because they've had it role modeled. And that's very compelling. I want my child to be very good at setting boundaries and keep themselves, you know, safe and happy in life.
And I think one of those boundaries is rest and knowing it's okay to rest. And then I think that's, again, like a good example to set your children.
Yeah.
It's okay to rest.
Yeah.
And maybe particularly during the summer holidays, that's a perfect time to have some rest. They're exhausted when they finish school, if you've got school-aged children. So actually, it's okay if we have a lie-in and don't do anything today, you know.
Today, nothing. That's a good
thing. Yeah.
So one thing Root and Bloom does so beautifully is create spaces where parents can connect. You've got your next coffee morning coming up. Tell us a bit about this new style of event that you're creating, why you've created them, who they're for, and what parents can expect when they come along.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have a really good time doing our workshops previously, but, you know, took on board some of the feedback, and it was quite sort of knowledge intensive in many ways. So we thought, actually, something like a coffee morning where there's less pressure for people to attend in a space where they're going to be learning something, that can be quite a lot. Maybe let's create a space where they can just attend to just be themselves and just meet other mums who might be in a similar position. Obviously, we'll be there. So, you know, the conversations or questions about the things that we are passionate about are still possible, but in a more informal way. This is more a regular space. So we're doing the coffee mornings once a month now, and it's going to be just a space for mums to connect with other mums and also be able to speak to us. And we hope to be able to invite some great experts along the way as well, such as yourself. So, you know, they've got a whole heap of opportunity to pick on our expertise and experiences if they've got any specific questions or anything like that, but also just to hang out, just come as you are in a safe space, you know, and bring your bump, bring your baby, and make it regular. So hopefully forming that, you know, relationship with other women, creating those villages, those communities where you can lean on someone and you're in the same boat. And I think that takes a lot of the pressure off for women.
We're calling it First Monday Mums and Bump Coffee Morning. So it's going to be on the first Monday of every month. Our first one's on the Monday the 6th. And you, Elisa, will be there with all your lovely Montessori things for the children to play with. And yeah, so you can book that through our Instagram. And something else that we're doing, so again, going back to matrescence and how much we really want to help women to understand it, because we really believe it will help them and how they feel. We are going to be doing online matrescence masterclass sessions. We did one a few weeks ago, didn't we? And that went really well. So they're just an hour. They're not as intensive. And it's just focused on matrescence and what happens within matrescence. So identity changes, relationship shifts, all that kind of thing. And it'll be early evening, 6 or 7. So we've got our first one, I think, on the 16th of July.
Mm-hmm.
And we plan to do those again as fairly regularly, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Excellent. So if anybody is around on Monday, the 6th of July, remind me of the time.
It's 10 to 11:30 and it's Megan's in St. Albans.
And you get a drink and a something.
You get a coffee and a croissant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perfect. Sounds so good. And head over to your Instagram for the link to book Root and Bloom.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that brings us to an end of this interview. Nikki and Mariam, thank you so much for joining me again today and for sharing your insights on relationships, boundaries. I'm sure everybody got something really, really useful out of that. I certainly did. I think the work you do is so important, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to The Parent Show on Mix 92.6. Today, I was joined by Nikki and Mariam from Root and Bloom, talking about navigating the summer holidays, protecting our well-being, and finding connection through community. To find out more about Root and Bloom and their upcoming programs and Mums and Bumps Coffee Morning, visit their social media channels and local events listings. I'm Elisa Karkar, and I'll be back next time with more honest conversations to support and inspire you on your parenting journey. Until then, take care.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury and today I'm delighted to be joined by Binny Fagura from Raiden Solicitors here in St Albans, the sponsors of The Parents Show. And Max Lewis from 29 Bedford Row. Max and Binny, it's fantastic to have you back in the studio. Thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So I really love the topic of today's discussion. It sounds like it'll be a little bit juicy. What goes wrong in family law? So, Binny, you and Max work together on a regular basis. Can you tell us a little bit about your role, Binny, first, and then Max?
Thank you, Lydia. So normally when things go wrong, Max is on my speed dial and I'll call him and panic. So I'm a senior associate in our St Albans office, specialising in family law. And my role is to meet clients initially, take instructions, and then when we need expert advice, I would call a barrister such as Max Lewis.
Fantastic. Max.
That's very kind. Beanie and solicitors will be able to sort out 99% of problems that happen in divorce. But the 1% that can't be sorted out and needs to go to a judge, that's when I come in and I deal with that side of all the things. So I only see the stuff that's that bit more extreme, that bit more juicy. And quite entertaining.
Yeah, and fascinating, particularly for listeners. You know, it's an area that we're all very interested in. So you, between you, Binny and Max, I'd say you've probably seen every kind of scenario that crops up in family law, and you've got a wealth of experience. And so I'd love you to share a little bit of some of the scenarios that you go through with us today.
Thank you, Lydia. Yes, so we often have straightforward cases, and there can be complex cases. So what I was going to do is give Max some scenarios and he can then let us know what he would do in those situations. So the first one is when you have a husband and wife that have connections to, say, England and another country. Marriage breaks down, husband goes off and starts divorce proceedings overseas, and then the wife starts divorce proceedings in England. It seems that both courts have some connection to the family. But what happens, Max, in a case like this? And how do the courts decide who gets to hear the divorce? And why is timing so important?
Only one country should be dealing with divorce. Nobody should have a situation where one legal system says this and the other legal system says that. It's a complete mess. So most countries have a rule that says you have to look at which country is the most appropriate, the legal phrase we use is convenient for the divorce to happen. And if you can't agree about which country should do it, so long as you've got the sufficient connection with that country, you go to the judge, you have an argument about which of those is most convenient, and the judge will make a decision and either say, actually, England is going to happen here, or you have to stop things in England and it will happen in the other country. Used to be until Brexit, it was really within the EU, it was about who got their papers in first, but we've now got rid of that and it's really about which is the most appropriate place for things to be happening.
Is it really a race? Do you think it's...
It can be. I mean, you do get some people who like, well, I started this all first and how dare you. But actually, I tend to find that the winner hasn't really won by very much. And arguments about which country things should happen in are almost always about money. And it's almost always, you know, the wife thinks she'll do better in England or the husband thinks they'll do better in Italy or Canada or wherever it is. And it's only ever about money. And I tend to find that it's you need to have a certain amount of money to be able to justify having an argument about it. If you've got no money, then why are you arguing about it in the first place? But, you know, as I'm sure we'll get to, one of the things that we see are that people make ridiculous choices when they get divorced. And part of our job is to help try and talk them out of it or at least talk them down from it.
Max, what does the balance of convenience mean?
It's all to do with which, where it's going to be easiest to resolve it. So usually it's about, well, where is the evidence? Where are the witnesses? Where is the house? Where are the assets? Where are the things that are going to be argued about? So England is a bit of a funny country legally because it is able to deal with assets across the whole world. And doesn't really matter where it is, but English law will deal with it. Other countries take a different view. So a lot of other countries say, well, if the assets aren't in our country, then we're not very interested. We haven't got the power to deal with it. So that's why lots of people want to come to England. It's got the broadest possible powers. But it's all to do with where is it going to be most efficient, where is it going to be cheapest, and where's the natural place for this to happen. If you've got two people who live their entire life in England, but one of them happens to technically have the right to divorce in Japan, the courts are going to say, oh, what the hell are you doing that for? Complete waste of time and money. Just have it all done here.
And do you think, in your experience, the court takes quite a robust approach to spouses who can be quite difficult in contesting divorce proceedings?
Yes, because for the last probably, well, certainly since I've been qualified, there's no shame in being divorced anymore. Right? When I first qualified back in the early 2000s, people were still thinking, well, actually, if a marriage is a bit rocky, we've got to try and do what we can to save it, and let's try and, you know, try and get these people back together. But actually now people are beginning to say, well, actually, if it's not really working, the best thing we can do is to try and end it with the minimal possibility of fuss. And things like arguing about which country things are going to be happening just adds a layer of fuss that no one needs. It just gets in the way and it becomes expensive and unpleasant. And if there are kids involved, then it's just, you know, you've got better things to do with your time than be arguing about this kind of stuff. Is that increasing recognition?
Thank you. I was then going to move on and talk about financial matters. We see this often. You may see it as often as well, Max. But a couple separate after a long marriage. The husband tells the wife, don't worry, you can keep the house. I'm not going to do anything. Key goes off. She carries on living in the house. They didn't take any legal advice. Never got this important document called a financial consent order. Years pass. Wife stays in the property, and naturally the house doubles in value, becomes worth significantly more than it was before. Then the husband comes back on the scene. Oh, this house is worth a lot more than when I left. There was never any agreement, and the wife is now panicking. What would happen in that situation? How exposed are the parties?
They are exposed to two different things. There is the risk of what the court's actually going to do at the end of all of this, and there's the exposure to the cost of finding out what the court's going to do at the end of all of this. So the best advice is always, at where there is a big change, some big life event, whether it's a birth or a death or a divorce, just kind of sit down and take stock, and if there's stuff to be sorted out then. If you leave it and it festers, you're just building up a huge problem for the future. So if you have separated and you've left things for a long time, English law will try to ensure that it does the fair thing and try to say, well, if you've been separated for a long time and somebody's built up some assets after they've been separated, we'll try and make sure that, you know, you keep what you've built up and perhaps the other person doesn't get a share of it. But if one party genuinely needs the assistance financially from the other party, the court can still get involved. So the best way of protecting yourself is to write things down and come to an agreement when these sorts of things happen. And the court can get involved later, but it won't want to unless there's a very, very good reason to.
Yes, just echoing the importance of then having a financial consent order filed and sealed by a court, so then you're bound by it.
I have to tell you, I pay my mortgage on the back of people being disorganised and not making the decisions properly when they are happy. And the biggest thing that causes problems down the line are where people lend money or borrow money to each other and don't write down an agreement at the time that they do it. So a young couple in their 20s, they get together. One of their parents says, oh, well, look, I've got some money, I've had an inheritance, whatever it is. Here is the deposit for a house, right? And then 10 years later, surprise, surprise, they get divorced. And no one's written anything down about what the terms of that arrangement were. Was it a gift? Was it a loan? Was it an investment? And I've seen people spend huge amounts of money arguing about misremembered conversations 10, 15 years ago. When in fact, because people in England don't really like talking about money. It's seen as being quite gauche. It's seen as being quite unpleasant. But actually, if you don't have those conversations and you don't make the financial arrangements and write things down as opposed to, whether you're separating or whether it's because you're getting involved in a financial transaction, you store up an enormous amount of problem for the future.
Max, can I just ask, in terms of clarification on the house, like the scenario that Beanie presented to us. So if the wife was paying the mortgage or paying council tax and that can be evidenced, is it likely that she gets to keep the house even though the ex-partner or husband turns up after 10, 15 years? Do they kind of look into that level of detail and evidence that that the wife has more kind of ownership over the property?
They can do. The way the law is phrased is that the court has to look at, and the magic phrase is, all the circumstances of the case. That's what it has to look at. It has to look at everything. It looks at the history. It looks at who's put in what. It tries to make sure that there is a kind of fairness between the two of them. So if somebody has moved out of a house and the other person has been paying the mortgage and paying the council tax and the bills and everything else, that will have an enormous amount of weight. But ultimately, at the end of all of this, it depends on often who needs what. If somebody's in a desperate situation, the court will try to help them. And if that means departing from that, then so be it. But the court has to try and be fair to both of these parties. And that requires looking back at how they've arranged things during the time that they were together.
I'm kind of surprised by that. That's kind of refreshing to hear, actually. It sounds very humane.
It is humane. And I think the judges like to believe that they are being humane. But the problem is that fairness is such a difficult and subjective word, is that what's fair for me may not be fair for Beanie and vice versa. And people have their own sense of what constitutes fairness. But I think there's an increasing understanding now that what we mustn't do, and the big thing that's happened in the time that I've been qualified, is treating the contributions that people make by having children and looking after kids and taking the career break and everything else, that is as valuable as going out and working, right? It's a different kind of contribution. But the idea that you should only give back money to people that have put in money is seen as being very old-fashioned nowadays, thankfully. We've moved on quite a lot.
I think that'll make a lot of parents listening in very happy.
I suspect half of the listeners will be happy with that.
I wonder which half.
Oh, that was great. I'm going to move on to social media, which is fantastic, but can equally pose a problem sometimes in family law proceedings and general life. So in a situation where we are in the midst of financial proceedings, one party tells the court they're struggling financially, they've got very limited resources, but social media paints a very different picture. It shows expensive holidays, designer purchases, things like that just don't match the disclosure they've given. Firstly, Max, can we use that social media evidence in family proceedings, and how seriously would the court take it?
It's a really tricky question. It feels like I'm in an exam. I mean, you've got two separate problems. The first problem is that just because it's on social media doesn't mean it's true, right? People spend their entire time lying about what a wonderful life they're living on social media. When, you know, I don't want to sound like a terrible old misanthrope, but actually people just aren't living it up in the way that they describe on social media. But the second is that English law tends to say, well, actually, let's have a look at the documents first. Let's have a look at the bank statements first. Let's have a look at the mortgage statements and let's see what we can do. And if there's a big mismatch between what the financial documents say and the life that you appear to be living, then fine, we can start looking at other things like that. Because if you are actually in Dubai when you say you've got no money, then that's, you know, quite a difficult thing to get out from. But the bigger thing with social media, actually one of the big things that's happening certainly in America at the moment, are people who are posting lots about their kids in social media where the other one doesn't agree. And you're having, and particularly because you can't delete that stuff.
No.
What are they? There's a phrase that the Americans use. I can't believe it's about having, you know, your child is growing up online. And I find that actually social media has become just something else for parents to argue about. I don't know whether, Beanie, have you got the same experience as
yes,
me?
Yes, and I do agree with that. I remember the case, I recall the case in America where there have been disputes now, because if you're separated and one parent is putting all those posts up on social media, there's no way to really stop them.
Mm.
Is it the right to be forgotten? Is that?
I think that's part of it. That is part of it. That's generally about people who have done things that are naughty and having the right to delete it. So if you try and Google, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell. You're not going to find very much about her previous posting. Fine. But social media has become much more... People are living their lives through social media now. And actually, some of the things that we find, it's not so much that people, at least in my experience, it's not so much that, well, you appear to be wearing a diamond necklace on this website, on this Instagram post, and you've told me that you haven't got any money. It's more that they're using social media to slag each other off. And it's becoming another tool to get at each other. And actually, because that stuff stays around and doesn't get forgotten or deleted, you know, if you go through someone's Instagram posts 5 years ago when they were separating, it's all still there, all the invective, all the hatred, it's all kind of festooned across the Instagram website, and it causes a big problem. Because actually, people should, this is going to sound terribly simplistic, but just people ought to be nicer to each other. And social media makes that more difficult.
I agree. I do agree with that.
Do you, I'd love to ask you both, actually, do you think there'll be, do you think the law will intervene in the future to actually stop parents being allowed to post about their children? Do you think we're going down that avenue, or do you think common sense is going to prevail?
Again, you've got two problems. Sorry, I keep on talking,
but no,
it's
just
it's what I do for a living. You've got two separate problems here. The first is that English law says where parents agree about what's best for their kid, then English law isn't going to get in the way. The court's not going to get involved because parents are assumed to do the responsible thing because they have this thing called parental responsibility and they can do the right thing by their kids. The bigger problem, actually, we're not going to see for 15 years when children who grew up that way begin to complain about what that was posted about them when they were younger. And nobody is really taking that very seriously yet. Because I know, I'm looking back at, I'm sure it'll be the same with you. I look back at some of these stupid things I post about my own kids and they are mortified by it, right? I'm sure that your children are the same.
They are.
Right? Completely mortified about it. But, you know, one post, you know, when they're 3 years old, you know, running naked through a fountain, when they're in their 30s, is a different proposition. And no one's thinking about that yet.
So when we have, say, a divorcing couple, we go through a process of disclosure. We talked about this before when we were on the show. A document called a Form E that we would ask both parties to complete. The purpose of that is so that we can see the have a landscape of all the finances that the other party's got so that we can look towards settlement. And part of that disclosure process is us scrutinising all the kind of bank statements, etc. And I have had a case, you probably have as well, Max, where looking through bank statements, we've discovered that one of the spouses has been financially supporting a second family for many years. So lots of money has been spent on this other household. It was never disclosed during the marriage. In your experience, how would that affect the financial proceedings?
I mean, the first question is whose financial proceedings? Because if somebody, usually a man, has been having two separate families, they both in principle have claims against him. And assuming that neither one knows about the other, it's a bit of a mess. I've had a case where a guy had effectively two completely self-contained families, one here, one in a different country. And the divorce proceedings were ugly because both women were in court at the same time against him and they kind of clubbed up together. And it was all fairly entertaining. And for everybody apart from him, who just, he looked as if he wanted the ground to swallow him up. But look, ultimately, English law requires that everybody is open about their finances, that all the financial disclosure that you give is full and is frank and is complete and is understandable. And if you mess around with financial disclosure, a good solicitor will spot it and will come for you. And there are all kinds of orders that we can make. I mean, the most powerful one, it's not used very often, but we can do, just go straight to the bank. If you won't give us your bank statements, fine. We'll just get an order against the bank. They'll give it to us. Or we'll get an order against the tax office and they'll give us the information. So we get there in the end. In fact, you may have seen in the paper recently, we're recording this mid-June, but a couple of days ago. So, amazing story. Well, for everybody apart from my husband, 26 years it took her to get to the bottom of all of it. Went to the Supreme Court, up and down, went to various different courts. He was a solicitor, was hiding huge amounts of money. And after a 20-plus year campaign, she finally got, you know, I think 6 point something million out of him. Well, I think, you know, at the risk of him going to prison. So it can take a long time.
And that comes on to the next point about these assets that disappear or businesses that we don't know values of. And that I feel plays quite a big part in a lot of our contested proceedings, don't you think, Max? What happens if husband or wife think the other isn't disclosing everything they should or being resistant to having businesses valued?
The judge will say that they can't do their job without knowing what the assets are and what the values of those assets are. And we try to make sure that there is as much engagement and compliance by both sides as possible. But in a really extreme case, if someone's just not playing ball, then the court will say, fine, we'll do it without you. We'll go ahead and get this stuff valued and we'll go and make sure we get the disclosure orders that we need to know what is going on with all of this. But it's quite, certainly I find English laws it's become very sophisticated. Like, we know what we're doing. You know, we've been valuing businesses for a very long time. We've been, you know, I think there's something about the fact that you have lots of accountants and lots of lawyers and lots of experts, all of whom are available if we need them to come and help. It gets expensive if someone's pleading. I mean, the real problem actually with non-disclosure cases are the cost of them. Because if someone's really being difficult and really not complying, you've got to chase and you've got to chase and it becomes very unpleasant and very difficult. But we will get there in the end. And I probably in 25 years, I probably had a handful of cases where I've been left with the feeling that we didn't quite get to the bottom of it. But it's really only at like less than five in 25 years I've genuinely felt that. We get there in the end.
Yes. And I see clients from the outset. So I'm usually client's first port of call. And a lot of anxieties they have is you will just never know. I know that my husband or wife is very good at hiding the family business. They won't say anything. Things will be happening in the background. And I assure them that actually, if this does get to a point where we are in final hearing and they're still not disclosing the information required by, say, a court, we can invite the court to draw inferences. Did you want to tell us about that, Max? When you go to court and you are at a final hearing, when we ask the court to draw inferences, what that means?
It's quite technical, but what it means is that if the judge is persuaded that there is money that is being hidden or there is something going on that they're not being told about and there is enough evidence about stuff surrounding it that justifies this, the court can say, well, actually, even though I've got no direct proof of it, I'm pretty certain there's a big amount of money over here and I'm going to treat you as if you've still got that money. But actually, you know, one of the problems is that there's often a difference in the level of sophistication between the husband and the wife, and particularly with Bitcoin, actually, in cryptocurrency, where the stereotypical example is that you've got a husband who's trading in Bitcoin and the wife doesn't really know what that is, wouldn't know how to access it, certainly wouldn't know how to trade and deal with it. And then they go to the solicitor and they say, I think my husband's got some Bitcoin. I'm not sure how much, and I'm not sure where. And he says, what are you talking about? I've got no Bitcoin. How dare you? How dare you? Getting to the bottom of that is really difficult because you don't definitely know that it's there yet. I'm sure you must have had that in your
We've
couple of your cases.
Had that quite a lot. It's becoming more and more common, but it still adds a lot of difficulty to our cases. So let's talk about a big lottery win. Married couple go through a divorce. They do deal with their financial claims. They have a sealed order by the court. 3 weeks later, wife wins the lottery. What can the husband do?
If something happens very soon after you've struck a deal with your spouse that completely changes the financial landscape, a lottery win, somebody dies, an inheritance, something big happens, then so long as it's pretty soon after and so long as it was completely unforeseeable, right? Nobody knew this was going to happen. You can't predict a lottery win. Then you can go back and you can say, well, actually, we need to look at things again because it's been really, really soon after this all happened. After, you know, generally 3 months, 6 months, that becomes very, very difficult to do because everybody knows that things are going to change later on. This is just one of the things that have changed. There are lots of cases. There's one particularly big case about a lottery win and a stupid argument about whose pound coin it was that was used to buy the lottery ticket and whether that made a difference. It's called S&AG in, I think, 2011. But yeah, we can. Lottery wins are quite a dramatic way of looking at it. But, you know, inheritances or business gets bought or. And the classic case is somebody who dies. very soon after an award. You know, imagine you're a husband and you're divorcing from your wife. And then 2 weeks later, she gets hit by a bus. Have you still lost half your house? Right? These are complicated questions.
They really are. I mean, Binnie, you've shown us a lot of curveballs and things that I never really thought of and scenarios, but it's so interesting to hear how you navigate it using the law. But and crypto, of course, crypto is going to play a role in divorce. And it's astonishing you're seeing it on a day-to-day basis. Is it traceable at all, Binnie?
It's a tricky one. If we're acting for, say, the wife who thinks husband's got thousands and thousands in crypto, he'll say it doesn't exist, and will provide statements, and it's quite difficult to track. But the position for the wife would be, well, it exists and it should form part of the matrimonial pot. But have you had quite a few arguments in court about it now, Max?
Yeah,
fighting over it because it's kind of there and isn't there.
The big thing to know about crypto is that it all starts with the first purchase of crypto. That is, you buy your first crypto with non-crypto, right? So the very first time, the very first bit of Bitcoin you buy is done with cash from your bank. So once you find that transaction, you know where you can follow. But if you can't find that transaction, it can be incredibly difficult. Because the whole point about Bitcoin is it's supposed to be anonymous and, you know, can't be traced and all the rest of it. But no, we are getting increasingly sophisticated at finding it and knowing what to do with it. And judges actually know. There is something called the Judicial College, and they get specific training on this. Every couple of months they sit down over a cup of tea and then somebody goes in and talks to them about crypto. Or there was, I remember NFTs a couple of years ago was the whole big thing about, you know, pictures of cartoons of monkeys that were worth millions of pounds. Remember this whole thing?
No.
I mean, it was a flash in the pan that you really haven't lost if you've missed it. But it was a similar thing. It was all online. It was all to do with, you know, blockchains and all the rest of it. And they got specific training about that. So the judges are quite sophisticated about it. There are experts who are quite sophisticated about it. But again, if you're going to start chasing it down, it gets quite expensive. So you need to make sure that you go to somebody like Binnie, who will know what she's doing rather than having to scrabble around panicking like a headless chicken before they get started.
And that's the advice to clients. I think a lot of people go through a process and they will be scared. But what I would like to say is it will be okay. There is a network of lawyers and judges who are familiar with people who will be difficult through proceedings, non-disclosure. And when things are really tough, I will go to someone like Max.
I think the thing to remember as well is that I've done this for 25 years. It would be impolite to guess how long Binnie has done it for.
So kind.
Judges have done it for longer. There genuinely is nothing new under the sun. Like, we've seen it all before. I can't remember the last time I was genuinely shocked by something that I saw. Because, you think that guy's a wrong one. Well, I've got this guy next week who's done, you know, 10 times worse. And for the client, for the person who's caught in this is the biggest thing, and this is really huge for them, and it's life-changing for them to be going through all of this, with all the stress and all the panic that comes with it. But a good solicitor will just lower the temperature. It's okay, here's what we do, here is step one, here is step two, and that's what you need, is just to be able to plan your way through it.
It's brilliant, and it's a relief, I would say, to parents who are listening in, to know there's that compassion and determination and fairness to make sure the right thing happens in the end and that the law is on their side.
I was told by one person who told me that she heard it from a very, very senior judge. And she said to me this woman, there's only one rule in family law. The language has to keep clean. So the best I can say is that the bad guys always lose. That's the only rule.
I think that's a good note to end our discussion today on. But it's genuinely good to know. It's good to know that the bad guys don't win.
The bad guys don't win. It may take some time, but the bad guys don't win.
Yes. That's brilliant. Oh, very, very heartening. It's been so illuminating, again, speaking to you both, and I'm sure our parents will get a lot out of the conversation. Binnie, Max, thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show.
Really a pleasure. Thank you,
Max.
Us.
So thanks. thanks so much to Max Lewis from 29 Bedford Row and Binny Figura from Raiden Solicitors for joining us on The Parents Show. Raiden Solicitors are, of course, the sponsors of The Parents Show.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.